Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to go over some brief news for 1.0 and a lot of news for 2.0. We're going to jump into a pre-recorded segment we have about the Targ spoilers with Darknotch and Scantrail, and then followed up with the rest of the 2.0 news, joined by Florian Mass. Finally, we're going to close off with the usual closing comments. Welcome to episode 23. As we mentioned last week, John is away and will be away for a couple more days, so I'm running this one by myself. We did manage to get John in a segment for this week that we recorded before he took off, and I managed to bring on some guests for the other segment as well, so it won't just be me talking, but I will try and keep the intro and other bits brief so you're not forced to listen to me forever. News that I'd like to go over for the week includes the fact that on CardGameDB we had another official post from Pipes talking about the deck builder and when it was going to come out. This was actually the bad news for some of you, that it was actually going to be delayed until just after Gen Con in order to preserve some of the spoilers for the people opening the boxes at Gen Con. Given that I'm one of those people, I'm not all that upset about the idea that that the rest of the world will have to wait a couple extra days, but it does put some constraints on deck building in advance for the Kingslayer tournament, although given that we don't know the deck building rules, maybe that doesn't really matter. Obviously, there's been a ton of 2.0 news, and I'm going to focus on that, but before I do, I want to mention the biggest item of 1.0 news that we had this week, and that was the Norwich Regional that happened. That was in the end won by Marco playing a Greyjoy HOD Longship Maidensbane. Tournament was streamed, and the stream was a blast. I tuned in as often as I could on that Saturday. Not only the semifinal game was absolutely insane between Marco and James or JC Wama. I think JC was held at 14 power for four turns. It was really a nail biter, a lot of fun to watch. The commentary overall was very light, very fun. There was some banter, including with the people such as myself in the commentary stream. Which I guess won't mean as much to those of you who weren't there at the time. So this is one of those you had to be there moments, you missed it. But a lot of fun, and props go out to the people who ran that stream, which was excellent, and I very much appreciated that. The rest, 2.0. There's the new tutorial video, which everybody's talking about. There was the Targ spoiler article, and by the time you listen to this, there will probably have been the Greyjoy spoiler article, as well as the new Quill and Tankards regular, which was delayed by a week but showed up last week on Thursday. So that gave us some new insights into the rules. So obviously this episode is mostly going to focus on 2.0. And then if Darknotch disagrees, then when he's back, he can take the reins and we can nudge things back towards 1.0. Hopefully we'll have an FAQ next week, so we'll have tons of nice 1.0 content to balance this bias out. All right, so we're joined today by Scantrail. He's been on the cast before. We've talked about his new player thread resource. And if you haven't been following his spoiler spreadsheet for 2.0, you've been missing out. That's probably the most complete list we have so far. So thank you very much for joining us, Scantrail.
He's also known for sharing a ton of decks with the community. Like, I see some months you just get like on a roll and you make two decks from every house and you share them. I think that's great. I think sharing that stuff is good. And Alex knows that recently I haven't been sharing as many decks as before, and it's actually starting to bother me. So I'm glad there's others out there doing it.
Yeah, I do what I can. I actually have John Bruno signed my Mad King Eris for me and wrote Agot Cards is on fire with your decks.
Nice. That sounds awesome. Like John as well. So speaking of on fire, Thanks. That was a really good lead up, actually. Thanks for feeding me that line.
No problem.
We're going to talk about the Targ spoiler article that went up today. Any big first thoughts?
Yeah, before we get into the cards, it's got this like nice banner at the top, and it's got this really wicked picture of, you know, I think one of the Targaryens pulling his sword, and that's awesome. And then right across, it has his brother laying down, but he's wearing this fake brassiere, and it's so weird. They're calling him Daenerys Targaryen. Like, what's up?
I thought you were going to mention that the really, really good-looking crest in between them.
There's that, too. But seriously, like, the art is so good except for the main centerpiece. And when you break out that centerpiece art and they have the little dragons, it's awesome, too. It's just they foobarred Dany beyond belief. Well, actually, they foobarred Khal Drogo pretty good, too.
Okay, but there's the Dany on Fire and Blood, for instance.
Which is amazing. Oh, yeah.
So art is a secondary concern. We're not a visual media. Well, Scantral, why don't you start us off with your first impression?
Well, Terminal Burn has never been my favorite mechanic from first edition, and it looks like that's carrying over into second edition. So I might just have to play it myself. And
Yeah, but it doesn't look like it's going to be easy to do, though. I mean, the need to kneel either Dany or a dragon is tough. Danny's a pretty good character, especially if you have a dragon on the board. And the dragons seem to be decent, but you're still losing one of your blocking chuds, even, is a high cost. And it's conditional. What if you draw the burn and no dragon?
I lean Scantral's side here on at least on Dracarys. If we look at Plaza of Punishment, the one where after you win a power challenge, you get to choose a character without attachments and give it -2 strength and kill it if it's zero. That's an on the board presence. It interacts with challenges. It has, you know, a fairly constrained strength limitation, and it's not happening mid challenge, which I think is important as well.
That doesn't synergize with Dany.
Well, it does in that it has -2 strength for the rest of the turn or the rest of the phase.
Right, but then I just don't attack with that character and I won't get the extra -2 to kill it.
But that and Unsullied and so on, all these strength boosts and then this sort of Plaza of Punishment as the kill condition, that module I like a lot, but I don't like Dracarys. Dracarys is point and click. Dracarys is -4 strength. Just because it's clunky, which it is a terrible balancing reason. Because as soon as you can make that consistent, it becomes the best card in the game.
With Dracarys, we've already seen the summons plot, which will let you get one of those dragons or Dany. And we've also seen Power Behind the Throne, which can stand Daenerys again.
And we've seen Fire and Blood, the card in this article.
Yeah, I think that was from the video.
That's right, it was up front. So we know that there's consistent ways to keep the dragons in play. But even, you know, it requires another card and it's a gold and all this stuff. Even if it's clunky, I still think clunky is a bad way to balance a powerful effect.
The way they're doing it, though.
Dracarys worries me in the long term. In the short term, probably not as much. But in the long term, yes, Dracarys seems wrong. At least it's only participating characters and there are some ways to play around it. But I guess you can make your challenge with Lady Catelyn from Stark and know you're safe from it. But otherwise, it just seems very, very, very dangerous.
And we have seen event cancel, but that doesn't mean you can make incredibly powerful events and count on them being canceled every time.
And I don't think that Bran is likely to stay alive very long against Targ if you have a little bit of burn there. Mm-hmm. So Targ also, I mean, probably we've seen this before, but is getting this more black color scheme rather than the red one, which has gone to Lannister. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone, but I think they pulled it off quite nicely. I think it looks pretty neat.
Looks really good.
I agree.
And it doesn't look like the Night's Watch, which is also using some of that same color palette for the black. Huh. So what about the centerpiece? How do you guys feel, aside from the art, how do you guys feel about Dany and the dragons?
I think she's well balanced. I love the insight keyword so that, you know, if some of her dragons aren't there, you can start to use her to try to get some draw going, get those dragons in play so that she can power up. And she's got a cool effect just on her own to synergize with the burn. Like you said, Alex, before, that there's this interesting on the board burn module that she's part of. But you always have to have this trade-off, especially for the first player. Do you use her in a challenge? She's 5 strength. You know, she's not a chud. She can draw you cards. Or do you keep her standing to have those little burn effects?
With the insight keyword on Daenerys, the article does mention that they have the snowballing potential is one of their main focuses for this house. So I would expect to see a lot of insight from the Targaryens. But we haven't seen any other draw, right? Their three-class location, unlike the Red Keep and Lannisport, doesn't draw cards.
Nope.
Burn stuff.
It burns stuff. Yep. And I think the Dany as a centerpiece seems to be a fairly good place to start the faction. I think it allows people to jump in from the shows and see the character they mm-hmm. like, allows them to use the dragons, but have the dragons be what grants Dany power, not necessarily be eating people alive themselves. And I think that's kind of neat. One thing that has surprised me here is how they've thrown around loyal and not loyal on the cards that we've seen. Like, Dany is loyal, the dragons are not. That works, but that basically means that the dragon module is loyal, despite the fact that the dragons themselves aren't.
Well, unless there's other cards that synergize if you have, you know, a hatchling or a dragon or whatever in play.
And then Dracarys and Plaza of Punishment are both loyal, so that means the core of the burn module is loyal, as well as Dany. But then we have Unsullied that isn't. And then, as we were talking about last week, I wondered if the Dothraki would be a sort of coherent, non-loyal module, and the one we see, Khal Drogo, is loyal. So it looks like this is going to be a really hard faction to either splash or, yeah, use as a banner faction.
And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because in the books, they're across the narrow sea, and they're kind of on their own. They're not in, you know, at this stage of the game, because I think we're kind of seeing a chronological order that the dragons are all hatchlings. They're not really involved in the Westeros politics. They're not aligned with the other houses, and, you know, they're not in the Game of Thrones yet.
So do you guys think it's okay that some houses will be more easily splashed than others, or should FFG be aiming to keep it relatively balanced?
That's a good question. Yeah. I'm not sure.
I'm totally okay with it being different in the core. I just think as the factions progress, you know, in a year from now, we should have a nice even spread where everyone has some reason that you would want a banner with them. I'm not upset that Targaryen seems to not have that out of the core box. You know, in 2 cycles or 3 cycles, or maybe when the Targ box itself comes out, we might see a whole bunch of, you know, non-loyal Dothraki or mercenaries and stuff that would be useful to any house.
I'm kind of wondering what their non-loyal themes will be, though. As you mentioned, Khal Drogo's loyal.
The mercenary armies. That makes a lot of sense. You know, the Golden Company, Company of the Cat, and all these other mercenaries could all have some synergies and not be loyal.
Okay.
We could even see the 7, right? Like, we didn't see a lot of that. We saw, like, blue-lipped warlock and a few things in 1.0, but we could see more of those traitors, and they could all be not loyal.
Yeah, I don't know if I was always comfortable in 1.0 with some of those characters like Pyat Pree being Targ characters. I mean,
but now that you can make them Targ characters that are non-loyal, you kind of
I guess
that medley problem.
That's true. That's actually a good point as well. But yeah, it did somewhat bother me in the first edition that there were a lot of these cards which were painted as Targ and had probably never tried to help the Targ cause at all. They just happen to be in Essos, and therefore they're labeled as Targ cards.
Something had to be Targaryen, because they don't exactly have a wide power base.
I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, that's probably a decent point to give at least one non-loyal card. We happen to have a spoiler. I think people have already worked out that there's only one other unique character that we haven't seen. Scantrog, would you care to read our spoiler for this week?
Sure. This is Ser Jorah Mormont. He's a companion and knight. 2 gold for 4 strength with 2 icons. So far he's looking really good. He's got military and intrigue icon with renown as well. So you know the rest of the text box is not going to be as good. It says, if Ser Jorah Mormont has 3 or more betrayal tokens on him, sacrifice him. And a forced reaction, after you win a challenge in which Ser Jorah Mormont is participating, place 1 betrayal token on him.
Very cool.
So he's going to be really good for 3 challenges, and then he's gone.
Oh, I like him because he'll serve as a deterrent.
Third renown, actually, given the new timing structure we have. he's never going to claim a third power. Because that renown would be after you've triggered after winning a challenge reaction.
Right, right.
However, I really, really like this card. Not only do I think it's really powerful, when I was asked what I thought Targ themes would be, quite a long time ago, actually, in episodes, I thought that having these characters with drawbacks, that if you lose, like sort of Bolton-esque maybe, once you lose the trust of Miri Mazdur or that she's plotting against you, you're using her on your side, but then something goes terribly wrong. And I like the idea of those characters, and I think I would love to see more of that, and I think Jorah is a good example, a really good character, but you got to be careful with him backfiring, with losing him, etc.
It plays well into the Targ theme, right? That they're trying to get to this critical mass, this place where they can start rolling and going, is what they're saying. And he's perfect for that, right? He's a big wall to buy Targaryen the time needed to get their rush on, or their steamroller started.
Right, so early in the game, he's going to be a boss and win you a couple challenges all by himself.
I hesitate to say this, but at this 2-cost slot, we have seen nothing come even close to him for power level.
Mm-hmm.
He looks really, really good, even if you're only getting to use him in 3 challenges. That's better than most 2-cost Chud. Generally, you're losing them in the first challenge they participate in. This is Chud you're going to want to keep around.
And you could also run more than one copy in your deck, probably.
Right, because you're reliably going to sacrifice. That's right. Right. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm actually really happy with this card. Much more so than with like Dracarys or the fact that Khal Drogo is loyal, which kind of sort of grates at my sensibilities.
Bad art.
Yeah. And, it seems strong but balanced.
I think we're allowed to harp on the bad art for Khal Drogo because I have no idea whether he's actually, like, both of his hands are on the same side of the horse.
Because he's not riding that horse. He's actually trying to take it from someone else. He's riding that rock that he's on. You see?
Oh,
he's on
okay.
a rock in front
height.
Of the horse, and
either
he's sitting
he's
on that rock.
14 hands tall by himself, or the horse doesn't have any back legs. I don't know. All of these are possibilities.
He's sitting on this outcropping, and the horse is riding by, and he's just grabbing hold of it.
Ah,
yeah. That's okay. The only way I could explain the art. So bad.
Okay, what if he's jumping from the horse to cut someone's head off or something? Like
and
in the middle
what is
of
that under him?
I don't know what that is either.
No, I don't know.
Is that supposed to be part of a horse?
No.
I think someone might have drawn a Khal Drogo and someone might have drawn a horse, and then someone was forced to put the horse in the background with Khal Drogo.
maybe he's a centaur in second edition.
That would almost make sense.
Oh boy.
So, we were originally going to give everybody a canned episode with some stuff we pre-recorded, but there has been a ton of 2.0 news, so I'm enlisting esteemed guests to cover the content, and I'm joined now by Florian, all the way from Western Germany. In fact, were you born? No, you were born, it wasn't called West Germany, was it? You were born post-reunification.
Yeah. I have no idea what all that is about.
Ah, well. Well, you know that thing with Greece? It's that in reverse.
Well, foreshadowing.
Hey, this is predictive. We're recording this on Saturday. We'll find out what happens to Greece. So the very first thing that I'd like to talk about is the new Quillen Tankard's regulars. To me, it mostly jumped out as a sort of the kind of thing we expected to see, little cleanup touches to the phase structure, to the timing structure. Nothing that drastically changes how we think about the game. Just really nice to know that they actually did these intelligent little tweaks.
But I think there will be a few changes in here that will affect how the game is played in interesting ways, as you mentioned. For example, that now the first player always has to choose first. Also for things like Aftermath in the first edition, for example, would be in effect. That now the first player has to decide first, which can lead to, well, interesting situations. There are interactions where knowing what your opponent is discarding for the Aftermath, for example, is very important for your own game plan. If you have the Viper on the board, for example, if they have to discard their characters first, you can then adjust your board position to always have the Viper active. And I think this is something that they'll have to keep in mind in the future. Because
I like that you said Viper Active. For some reason, that turned into a single word for me. Viper Active. I really like that.
That is a single word.
Viper Active. Great. Yeah, I think you're right. The example they give is Wildfire or Reserve, which you'll be checking at the end of every phase. And in those cases, being first is probably not an advantage, being first player. Now, there are other advantages because we know that they decide all conflicts, regardless of whether you're in a framework action or not, between constant effects and which forced reactions go first. So it's more powerful in that regard than it was in first edition. But the fact that you have to show which cards you're discarding to reserve before your opponent does, that's giving away information. So there's a bit of a trade-off. One of the other changes that they mentioned in the article that I thought was quite neat is the change to stealth. And the only reason – I mean, most people were doing it that way anyway, so it's not going to change the way most people's games go. But the fact that you go, I attack with character with stealth and I bypass this person, that's what you say. And so the fact that the game structure now matches that and you don't have to ask for pre-stealth actions, I think makes sense. I also think it's kind of neddly in that you can't stealth a character that ambushes you. Because how are you going to sneak by a character you didn't know existed?
Yeah. Another thing about this is that now tournament games are not going to last as long because of this change. Because you were asking about 15 times in any given game, any actions before stealth. And that whole part now just falls on the wayside.
Well, they can still have actions before declaring defenders, but generally that'll – yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's also – they're stripping the pre-plot action window, the pre-draw action window to unify the phase structure. And those are times where there's a lot of decision points which have now been moved to after the plots have been revealed, which I think constrains things a little bit. And I think will speed up gameplay a little bit.
Yeah, because to be totally honest, those phases from a gameplay perspective weren't really necessary in the first place. So it's good that they're gone.
Aside from that, I mean – the writer made a case for this Bear and the Maiden Fair card being good. I'm not sold yet. It's hard. It's true that on the early turns, it might just be a free card quality thing. I don't know. What do you think of that Bear and the Maiden Fair card?
I didn't read the last part of the article. I just read up to the pun. Bear with us because there's a fair chance we've made another pun and then I just stopped reading.
Yeah, well, that was the highlight. I mean, you might that's the mic being dropped, you know.
I know who's to blame. It's JC.
It is definitely JC.
Yeah.
Yep.
What a jerk. Well, I think I'm a hypocrite. I did read it. I just wanted to make a point there. I think they're likely correct, especially because in the first time, like the core set and first cycle, having a card that you can just play for zero is probably pretty good. But I don't think this will be around for longer than that.
The other big piece of news this week was the tutorial video, which I actually watched in its entirety, and then I watched it again, and then I sort of freeze-framed, and now there's a whole list of pictures. But before we talk about individual spoilers, just the tutorial video overall, what did you think of that?
I think they've done an excellent job with the marketing this time. And you really see that this is the biggest release in, like, is it the biggest release ever for a game?
I don't know about for a game, but for a card game, yes.
For a card game, and you really see that in little details. For example, I really like the guy who voiced this. It was very professional, and it's really saying we've stepped it up a notch. This is serious for us, and we want to make this happen. And I really appreciate that from their side.
One of the things that, I mean, I've watched the Conquest ones, the Star Wars ones, and so on. This one was one of the few that, as far as I could tell, didn't have any rules mistakes, which is a pretty good start. The other thing that I noticed is that they actually chose a fairly interesting challenges phase, right? It had a couple of decisions, which characters were going to attack, which ones weren't, and the decisions the players made actually made sense, which I think is somewhat helpful as well. I mean, their setups were awful. I would never have set up the Queen's Assassin. I'd have set up Tywin and a Rose Road. It would have been so much better. But those small details aside, the challenge phase was interesting, made sense, and they ended the first round with 5-4 power, so they sort of showed that this can happen quickly, although I don't know if playing Superior Claim then was the best move, it certainly showed that the stakes could increase quite quickly. So
the question is if having Superior Claim in your deck in the first place is the best move. But, I mean, we'll see. Maybe you'll have to play it because there are just not enough cards in the core set.
Well, it's free, right? I mean, you still have to win the challenge, but that is a good point, yeah.
I mean, that's just first edition comparisons at this point, so...
I do... One thing that a minor gripe with the video, not with the quality, which was excellent, and in fact, actually the visual appearance of the cards on the board, because I know I've knocked the art for Lannisters before, but when you see the whole game played out there, it looked great. And it might be, offset by Joffrey, who's a Magali art and therefore looks great as well. But just overall, the backs of the cards with the plot art, with the overall game setup, visually very, very nice.
The new house cards especially, because the old house cards, I mean, they have a certain charm at this point, but there are reasons why people printed so many different alternate art house cards over the years, because why is there a face structure on the house card? I mean, I kind of get it, but you could have just printed on the backside of the house card or whatever. But,
well, not anymore, because the backside is the alliance, or the treaty, yeah. You know, I've linked this video out to a bunch of people who were considering buying the game, who were thinking about it, who wanted to know more, and nobody said, well, that looks shitty. So that's good. That's what we want to see.
One thing I noticed about the video, and I really loved that, is that player one, the stock player, is male, and player two, the Lannister player, is female. And I think that is a very important point to promote the game to both genders. Especially because...
Jeez, you sound like Drakey or James. I mean, I agree, but this doesn't sound like the Florian I know.
Yeah. Usually I'm more of a chauvinistic asshole, but you see, now that John isn't on the cast, I thought I'd have to balance it out, I guess.
Fair enough. So I'll be asshole for today. Right, that's what you're saying.
What I was trying to say is, I think I remember Nate... telling us in the preview article that they had a playtesting group specifically for one core set. If you only buy one core set, how does that play out?
Yeah, the out-of-box.
That is a very important target audience, I think, to have one female and one male player, usually a couple who just pick up one core set and then stop playing. And that really shows that they're not only targeting the very competitive audience, but also a very casual audience, and it will broaden the game. And that's just... marketing 101, but very effective, and I like that.
Yeah, and I mean, Thrones has actually been one of the few card games where they have been using gender-neutral pronouns or he or she in rules text and card text in the first edition as well, which, it's not something you necessarily notice until you play another game and you notice, oh, wait, it all says his, or him. So I think those are good moves in the long run, and I think other things as well. In general, the art is not like the HBO show Sex Position. You know, it's a little more balanced. It's still got violence. It's still got, you know, sex. This is Game of Thrones, but it's not exhibitionist in either the violent sense or the sex sense.
And they have a bear licking hair, so that's great.
Hey, I actually really like that art as a sort of tapestry, the bear licking hair.
I do not. I see where they were going with this, obviously, but I think it just doesn't fit with the theme of the rest of the cards.
But how are you going to represent the bear and the maiden fair? I mean, you could draw a minstrel singing, or you could draw an actual bear, but if you show it as a tapestry about the story, it's clear that it's a story within this. No, I think that's a clever way of doing it.
I actually really like the idea behind the first edition of the Bear and the Maiden Fair art. Obviously, that doesn't work here because it's a Tyrell card, and Brienne and the Bear aren't really Tyrell characters, especially the Bear. And
that's the scene with Brienne, and that's right. Okay, yeah, that works too, I guess. That was clever.
I don't know. It's just a personal feeling, but...
Mm-hmm. Now, there were a ton of spoilers in this, and there's no sense in going over all of them, but... You know, maybe ones that jumped out at you, but also maybe a little more focus on the houses that we haven't seen yet. So Martell, Tyrell, and the other one. Greyjoy. There. How can I forget Greyjoy?
I'd like to start off with a general sentiment here. I think we can already see the factions are shaping out to be, in the sense of what are more likely going to be allied factions and what are going to be the main factions. I'm talking about competitive play now. For example, the whole Rolor, however you pronounce that, theme seems to be...
According to John, Raoul, but yes, okay.
Okay, so Raoul is a Krayjoy player, and he is not loyal. So what that means is that most of the cards you could play in another faction, and Melisandre actually adds a lot to another faction with repeatable Neil effects that maybe Targaryen that have burn and can kill smaller characters really like to have access to. And I think that's how it's going to shape up in the core set meta.
I think the only loyal card we've seen with the R'hllor trait is the Lightbringer so far. So I think you're right. I think that's a self-contained, non-loyal module that you could splash into a house.
Yeah.
And I think we may have seen some of those in other cases, but in other cases it wasn't as clear. Like for Targ, we haven't really seen... I mean, the Burn module has loyal bits to it, the Dragon module has loyal bits to it, and Khal Drogo's loyal. So it doesn't look like there's a nice theme that has been decided is the sort of support mechanic for Targ.
Without having played any games with the cards, obviously, I'd say that the most likely faction combinations I see at the moment are Targaryen with Baratheon allies for a sort of burning control kind of deck that kills the small characters with burn and the bigger characters just kneels them. And the other combination I really like from the cards I've seen so far is Night's Watch with Mattel. Obviously, there hasn't been a Mattel spoiler article yet, so that could change. But Unbowed, Unbent, Unbroken is a challenge denial card, and Night's Watch seems to be focused around defense, and in the first chapter pack, they're going to get more cards that deny challenges when you're being attacked, and I really think those will fit together rather well. Mm-hmm.
I could definitely see that, and I think that the new Ariane we've seen is amazing no matter what deck you put her in, and she's not loyal, so Martell could be a good support faction in general. So plots, we've now seen, I think, all but three plots, if I'm looking at the spoiler lists as well, and the first thing that I see maybe two plots that I'm kind of thinking might be duds, that's a pretty good ratio. Like, the other ones I can all see uses for. So, I mean, of the plots I see there, I think maybe I'll be proven wrong, but rebuilding just looks like a plot that goes against the kind of thing that I do. And that's the one where you shuffle three cards from your discard pile into your deck. And I'm not a huge fan of minorly increasing the odds of you drawing a specific thing again. And then the other plot that I'm not sure is all that great is that taxation plot, although that might be required. It may be that if most of the economy is limited, this is one of the only ways to get an economic lead on your opponent. But aside from that, all the other ones look like the kinds of plots that, you know, with minor tweaks based on other things, that would see play possibly even nowadays in first edition.
Well, most of the plots would likely see play in first edition because... Well, there's
the
more
gold. Desire.
Gold.
That is a fair point. But I mean, also for what they do, they feel niches that we know are important. I mean, people have said Heads on Spikes is amazing. I mean, no fortified position is a very valuable plot. Targeted kneel for a character, very important. Drawing three cards, point and click attachment removal. All of these are nice things to have, and nice things to have in an evergreen core set that you're going to build on. There's a lot of checks and balances built in there, and I think there's going to be a lot of options in building your plot deck.
Yeah, I think this is really an important point here, because the plot landscape doesn't really change all that much compared to the deck landscape, if that makes any sense. Because when you add loyal plots, only a plot for one deck changes, and if you add one plot that is neutral, then some decks will be able to play it. But most of the plots that we see in the core set are going to be played for a long time, and especially because there's rotation, so it's good that they really took their time and tried to make all these plots playable.
To say that they're not going to build a better version of the same plot and then you'll never use it again. Sure, whatever. But the point is that the effects that we're seeing make sense in a core set context to me.
One thing about rebuilding is I think this card could have started out as choose up to three cards in your dead pile and shuffle them back into your deck in during design, but then that was dismissed because it was too powerful. Because that's the only way I could see this plot in a similar wording be useful.
I mean, it's not useless. I mean, from my standpoint, I'm just trying to be too nice to it. To me, that plot looks useless. Unless there are very specific mechanics that key off the size or content of your discard pile, this seems like the worst plot in this set.
Well, they knew that mill would be a thing, and people were milled out constantly, so they said, we need a plot to stop this, and
this plot will buy you one turn against mill.
Yay!
I guess. I doubt it'll see play for that reason. Moving on, so we actually have the largest picture we've had of the economy to date, because we see Littlefinger, a character who adds gold. We've seen the King's Road, a limited sort of sack for three reduction, kind of like a C except limited, which is a pretty big difference. And we've seen that beautiful looking Rose Road, which I want to comment on the art because we're probably going to be using this in every deck for ages. So I'm glad it's not as hideous as some of the limited Rose Road, Sea Road in first edition.
The question is, could you play a first edition Rose Road? I'm looking up the trade at the moment. Yeah, it's Westeros. Could you play?
It would be considered a proxy because they say that the cards are not compatible. So okay. Even though the text is there and I guess it's identical, it would be considered a proxy. I don't think anyone would be upset with that, but yeah. I think that technically you wouldn't be able to play it.
Because, I mean, yes, the artwork is better on this one, but nostalgia.
But nostalgia.
Just like, I've been playing this game for longer than you, and now we stop playing.
Yeah, that's what some of those are, the people who are running a bunch of black-bordered cards. They're just showing off.
Yeah, I always play... when I have the choice between black border and white border, I always choose black. Always take the black.
What does that tell you for economy? Now that we've seen Rose Road, King's Road, that we've seen a neutral character like Littlefinger, who looks amazing. He's marshal him, draw two cards, and he's a +1 gold character, and he's a reasonable stat line. So I have a feeling we'll be seeing a lot of him. What do you think about the economy? Is it all balanced by the fact that we start with 8 gold in setup?
I think we're missing the redundancy in income providers. That's one of the... Yeah, I think that's the thing. Because in first edition, we didn't start out with Flea Bottom, with Street of Silk.
Steel. Okay, we did have the steel and
we had ancestors. We had the icon reducers.
Yeah.
But we didn't have River Row, I believe. In the beginning, I think we're just going to be playing the Rose Road 3 times and then 3 times the Infection Reducer. And then it will be very important that you always use the gold on your setup, because that is going to determine a lot when your long-term income isn't that up to pace.
So do you think that that's a sort of temporary thing because they didn't want to include too many economy cards in the core because then it becomes boring and they needed to keep it engaging? Or do you think it's a conscious decision to try and slow the pace of the economy on subsequent turns down a little bit? Or to say, look, if you want economy, you have to play a plot for economy, something like a noble cause. Like, you want a good economy turn, you play an economy plot. And then so plot gold becomes meaningful?
That is a very good point, because in first edition, I'm always starting my statements with in first edition, because, well, that's all I play.
Yeah.
Obviously. Over the time, low gold plots have become much more viable, and the low gold income value has become nearly inconsequential, because when you're in the late game and you have 10 income providers, it doesn't matter when you flip a plot that only has one income. It's still going to be good because it has high initiative or has an amazing effect, but you're not going to suffer from the deficit in economy. And this can really help balance plots out in a sense that now you also have to worry about having enough gold to deploy characters. And sometimes you have to sacrifice playing characters for having an awesome effect on your plot card. Well, and that makes sense.
I think maybe the best example of that would be counting favors. We see this. This is the draw three cards, but it's, what, a 2-3-1, I think? Just going off memory. That would be amazing in first edition.
Yeah,
right? It would be absolutely amazing. Here, it's a trade-off. And trade-offs are good. Trade-offs are good design space. I mean, we obviously have to see how it plays out. But, you know, if you can't play any cards, if you can't play at least one card a turn, then obviously the economy's not working very well. But I think there's a way to make this work.
That's also probably the reason why the sea-like effect on the King's Road is also limited. Because in first edition, drawing cards also equates to drawing economy. You can basically draw your economy, which makes card draw much more powerful because more cards will always be playable because you automatically draw into more income.
Yeah.
And with that, you get this effect that now you have to balance drawing cards and playing cards, which is, for those of you who play Conquest, it's very important in Conquest to keep a balance because between both of your resources, because you cannot play your cards for free. Most cards cost something. And I really like the system, and I hope that they're going to continue with this in second edition.
Mm-hmm. Factions that we've seen spoilers for, I mean, we'd seen most of the Barra spoilers already, so I don't know if there's anything we want to jump into there, but I mean, I think we'd seen all of them. They hadn't given us anything new. But what they did give us some Greyjoy. And as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure many of the listeners know, Greyjoy is one of my favorite houses. I'm extremely pleased to see some things here. There are some cards I really, really like. Basically, when I'd first talked about Greyjoy in the prequel, the speculative article, where I talked about some of the things I wanted to see, I said, you know, I'd like to see warships that help win unopposed challenges and characters that benefit from them. And we see a warship, and it seems to be benefiting from unopposed challenges rather than helping win unopposed challenges, although it does a little bit of both. But it's a very – was it with you that we talked about tying draw to a faction's identity and how it was very, very important? It may have been with someone else, but as a way to differentiate factions. I thought it was with you. But anyway, here in Greyjoy, we see that their three-cost location, you know, akin to the Red Keep, which is drawing cards, and Lannisport, which is drawing cards, their way of drawing cards is by winning unopposed challenges. And that's good. That means that, sure, maybe it's a location that draws you cards, but in order to draw the cards, you have to do what the faction does. You have to play into the faction's identity. And to me, that's incredibly reassuring. That's a way of giving everybody draw without saying, this is the draw faction, but giving them different ways for exploring that draw. And so far, that's what we've seen. So to me, that's incredibly encouraging.
And I also think that warships, triggering off unopposed challenges, and characters that help you win unopposed challenges is the better way to go than the other way around. Because then what happens is what we see in first edition, that there are just warship decks that can win unopposed challenges with just a few characters out and almost on their own. I think it's better when
to have them supporting.
When you have to play characters that then can win unopposed challenges, and you still revolve your game around the characters and their supporting, yeah, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Now, what do you think of that attachment next to it, throwing axe?
That seems pretty powerful.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, it's almost like no quarter. But okay, you can only kill a defending character, so it's half stealth, half. It's weird.
It's kind of like deadly, right?
Yeah.
Except that it is happening before claim, which is a really important point because of the way the reaction structure works now, right?
Yeah.
So if they're going to chump block, you're still going to kill that chump, and they can't choose it for claim. So, and it doesn't matter whether you're doing this in an intrigue or power or military challenge, it has roughly the same effect. It's like deadly for all of them. Which, if, you know, deadly on an intrigue icon has always been good. This is deadly on an intrigue icon, even if it's military. It doesn't matter. So I really like this card, and I like the arc. I like the axe being thrown out at the player.
That's pretty good. I think this is one of the cards I have to see in play, because there's just... with cards like this, there's always a fine line between completely unplayable because no one ever falls for it and pretty amazing. And this one is just in the middle. I can't really tell where it's going to end up. But in the core set, it's probably going to be playable because there aren't as many cards. So,
but, I mean, probably, even if all this does is win you an unopposed challenge once a turn with that character, that's
good.
Good. Yeah, exactly. That's a power.
And
that's like renown.
With the new gold curve, it's likely that the character you kill costs more than one.
Yes.
So this is a good trade on resources. Okay, I have to retract my statement. Okay, it's going to be pretty good.
It's going to be pretty good.
I just realized that it gives you a head start on the resource curve, and that will be amazing in the second edition, because resources matter a lot more. Now, I mean, in the first edition, you just throw away your two-cost character, and you're like, okay, sure, he died, whatever.
So the big card, and the one that there's been a lot of questions asked about, is this Euron Crozai, who has a keyword we haven't seen before, pillage. And I've heard pillage everything from discard a card in play with cost or strength, or probably cost less than what you won the challenge by as an attacker. I've heard discard a card from opponent's hand. I've heard discard a card from opponent's deck. I don't know which it is. Or I do know, but I I can't say.
It's good that we have at least one guy on the show that isn't under NDA, so at least I can speculate freely.
So speculate freely.
I would say it's discard from the top of the deck.
Yeah.
First of all...
Seriously? Mill? Back? Why?
First of all...
Why would Nate do this to us?
He's invoked the little daemon in himself. And secondly, I don't think it would discard cards from hand, because that would be just injury claim, and that makes no sense. And discard from play seems too strong as a repeatable effect on a character. And I think Mill has always been a Greyjoy theme, so why wouldn't it? And his ability perfectly ties into the Mill theme.
I will at least grant that. If pillage is discard a card from your opponent's deck, it doesn't matter. In fact, it's probably going to hurt you against many opponents. Why would you want to discard a hatchling that they can fire and blood into play? That's just terrible. But
isn't that only from the dead pile?
I think it's only from discard. I might be wrong. Fire and blood is choosing in your dead pile. Ah, you're right. It is only from your dead pile.
Okay. And I'm right.
Oh, I just got owned.
32-0 for me.
Okay. But, you know, we know that seeding an opponent's discard pile is not that good in first edition. And I've ranted about Mill in the past. But if there is a way to do it, it's having effects that trigger off, or that interact with the opponent's discard pile. And we've seen some of those in first edition as well. So
and maybe, also probably tied to winning a challenge. I would not be surprised if it's like, after you win a challenge, your opponent must discard cards from the top of his deck equal to the strength by
which you won the challenge.
Which you won the challenge, or something like that. Because that at least ties it to challenges. You can not play the uninteractive game and just mill your opponent out and stalling for as long as possible. You have to at least win challenges and do something for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we, in the same sort of set of spoilers, we've seen at least one location that discards for its effect, and that's the King's Road. So there's a decent chance that even if you're not milling your opponent, you could pick cards like that out of their discard pile and accelerate your resources, assuming that you can put a limited location into play from a discard pile, but probably can.
Yeah, but working the same way in all SOGs, I don't know why they would change that.
So if there is a way that I won't hate it entirely, it's if there are a fair few effects like this that will interact with the discard pile that you've seeded. So I hope the Greyjoy spoiler that we see next week gives us a little more to go on, so I know whether to hate my beloved Greyjoy or love my beloved Greyjoy. Although I will say I'm not a huge fan of that art for Euron.
Is it an old artwork?
I don't think so.
I don't think it's new.
It might be from the board game?
Yeah, that could be.
Finally, the last card, because I'm obviously going to fixate on Greyjoy. We hadn't seen much from it. We do not so. I love this card. Absolutely love it. First of all, we know we need attachment hate in this game because you can't just deal with the characters they're attached to. So we need to have, and we've seen some plot that discards attachment. We need to have in-house, you know, ways to deal with attachments, and this one is there. But it's not just attachment hate. It's versatile. It's never going to be a dead card. Your opponent is either going to have an attachment or a location. And I'm very interested in seeing which you tend to use this against more often. But, you know, it's got a gold cost, as well it should, for an effect this powerful. It keys off unopposed, which builds into Greyjoy's identity, and it's never going to be a dead card. I foresee this card being used for a very long time.
Yeah, I would say it's going to be a 3-off for a very long time. Yeah, as you mentioned. It's just that it can target an attachment just gives it, like, a little bit more of an edge. Just that little bit more. And now that attachments go back to their owner's hand, when the character is discarded or killed, yes, this is going to be playable, very playable, and it's going to be played.
Lannister, I think the only new thing that we've seen is Joffrey, who has an ability very reminiscent of the first edition of gaining power if lords and ladies are killed. But we saw how...
Isn't it an actual reprint?
Is it an act? Was the other version a king? No, it wasn't. The other version had a noble crest. Ha.
Okay, it had a noble crest, but those didn't translate to second edition. So,
well, there's another thing that doesn't translate. He can't trigger off himself anymore if there's no Moribund.
Oh, yeah, but that's a rules change.
Yeah, but that's an important distinction because you frequently did on a Valor turn or something like that wind up with 3 power on him and finish off the game.
We are so freaking pedantic.
Yep. But aside from that, I guess we also saw Widow's Wail. I think that was the first time.
Yes, which is much worse than the first edition one.
Oh, because it doesn't draw cards. Still,
yes,
it's a 2-strength boost for 1 gold. It has ambush. You're never going to marshal it, right? You're always going to ambush it.
Yeah.
Because it's the same cost either way. So it's a surprise 2-strength pump that sticks around. That's a pretty good start.
The fact that this is a repeatable combat trick in the sense that when the character dies, you just get it back into your hand.
And you can pay another gold to put it back into play. Yeah, that's true.
Exactly. And in combination with the other ambush characters that Lannister has, for example, the Gold Cloaks, you ambush them for 2, then you ambush this for 1 more, and then for 3 you have a 5-strength attacker or defender that came out of nowhere, and then at the end of the phase...
And when the Gold Cloak leaves, you get the thing back. Yeah, that's actually quite good.
That seems like a common play to me.
All right, faction that we hadn't seen anything about, Martell. Want to walk us through what caught your eye in Martell?
Obviously, the Red Viper. Unfortunately, it seems like it doesn't win the game on its own this time around.
Oh, my God.
Although, it makes me sad.
I've heard many interpretations of this card text as well. Depending on what it is, it could basically win the game on its own. If he gains 1 power for each strength by which you won the challenge... And he's 7 strength. That's insane. that's just broken. So it's got to be something else. Can you imagine? You win 1 unopposed challenge with the Red Viper and you get 7 power? No. There's no way that's what it says.
Well, it's still not very good because he doesn't have immunity to character abilities.
He doesn't need to stick around. He only needs 1 turn if that's what you need to do with him. 7 power. That's not happening. Whatever it says something different. I refuse to believe that it says for each power.
I'm really interested in Gaston Grey as well. Maybe that's just because I obsessed with first edition. It's just seeing all these cards that were very powerful in first edition, on one hand makes me very sad because now they're balanced because people actually put enough playtesting time into developing them. But on the other hand, it makes me excited that now you can play this card without getting punched in the face repeatedly in tournaments. So that's a plus. Arion Martell.
The Gaston Grey art was very nice in first edition, and the fact that they reused that, I'm perfectly okay with it. It's a lovely piece of art.
Oh, by the way, why didn't they use the Villeneuve artwork for the Red Viper? That one is amazing. I always wanted the Villeneuve artwork on the Princess of the Sun
Storm.
Viper.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure what to make of this one. I'm not a huge fan of the art.
As long as you claim 7 power when you win another post challenge, who cares?
So what about the mechanic that underlies both Doran and Dawn? This idea that for each plot in your used pile, you're getting some benefit.
That's a very literal interpretation of the long game. And, well, I kind of liked it when it was not that clear. Like, when how your deck worked was the long game, and not this character is the long game. Like, you have to play the long game because this character gets better when you play the long game. Don't you want to play the long game? I liked it when you had card effects that are just better when you play the long game, but they didn't state explicitly that you have to do that. Kind of like in first edition and Bloodthirst, but
well,
I'm a sadist.
Yeah, I agree with you to some extent, but if there's one card that should really be telling you to play the long game, it would be Doran Martell, right?
Yes.
And he does. I mean, I don't know how – I mean, we've seen Arianne and we've seen the Red Viper, who's presumably a lord. Those are maybe the only two cards that benefit from it, in which case it's not that strong an ability. But you look at what you think of as the head of the faction, even though he's the 6 gold character, and he immediately tells you how the faction works. I think that's important.
And maybe someone complained about Targaryen in the playtesting phase, and they said, well, we have to design a counter faction for that, and then they put this ability on Doran. I'm not terribly excited, but I can see where they're coming from.
What I am excited by, though, is Arianne.
Oh, yeah.
Every game has a version of this effect. I think it's the Millennium Falcon in Star Wars. I mean, it doesn't matter which character it is. Beginners look at this and go, well, why would I return Arianne to get another character in play that might have even cost less? It just doesn't make sense. This is action economy. This is user in a challenge, bouncer, put something else in, and, you know, you can reduce her because she's a lady or she's unique or whatever other reducers you have. So you can make her cheaper, pay her for 3, then bounce her, put a character in for 5. This card is great. This card is phenomenal. The art is very nice as well. I look forward to some of the evil things one can do with this card.
Especially come into play abilities will be bonkers when you can just trigger them. For example, on characters that don't have ambush, when you can trigger a come-into-play effect that is actually only meant for marshalling in the challenge phase, that could just blow the game wide open.
Yeah, I think that's really neat.
I love it. This card is great. Looking forward to playing it.
So aside from that, we still haven't seen the article. We still haven't seen a lot from them. There were a few new cards for the Night's Watch. We saw Maester Aemon, who's pretty close to a reprint. Saves only Night's Watch characters now, but oh no, that's what the Guild version did.
He has an icon.
He has an icon. My God. That's true.
That's actually far away from a reprint then.
Although, he's no attachments, which is both encouraging and worrisome. If they ever print a Maester's Chain, and I think we saw one in the spoilers for the first cycle, we're back to a Maester Aemon that can't get a chain.
Well, flavor-wise, this actually makes sense. No, wait, it doesn't. What am I telling? But he could get an eritum that says that he has no attachments except for chains.
Yeah, yeah, let's not start thinking of Rata in second edition. Please, God, no. Benjen, though, we see has a theme that makes rangers not be bypassable by stealth, which I think clearly plays into this sort of defensive, protecting the wall thing. We still don't know whether that's going to work or not, but it's nice to see that there's support from very different angles on it.
The engine is going to be very powerful with only a corset, because we already talked about it on an earlier cast, I think, that you will have to play multiple copies of unique characters. And when you have a unique character that basically cannot die, in a sense, so that you can always replay him when you draw him again, mm-hmm. That's going to be pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. Benjen himself will be good, but the engine that he's built to power, the whole wall trick, I don't know.
Night's Watch plus Martell could be a challenge denial deck, mm-hmm. Very control-y, very grindy, and having a finisher like Benjen that can claim power on his own without you having to necessarily win challenges is actually kind of frightening.
Yeah, I mean, Benjen and the wall together, it could be 4 power a turn,
yeah.
Potentially, not having won any challenges. But you still have to have the characters on the board to oppose all 3 kinds of challenges and be able to prevent things like stealth. So it's not uninteractive.
I'm sure we're going to figure something out to make NPEs work.
Oh, yes. I'm sure you will. Moving on to Stark, the card that I think you will agree with me that is one of the more exciting cards to see is Direwolf Pup.
I was actually thinking Winterfell Steward.
Oh, I was going to go Direwolf Pup because that makes Lightworm Reign so much better. A non-unique,
that is true.
Cheap direwolf is going to make Lightworm Reign scary.
On the flip side,
And he's so cute.
Stark's income is going to be much better than that of the other factions because they have Winterfell Steward. With lower...
We don't know that the other factions don't also have a Casterly Rock, Castellan of the Rock, maybe, and other things, similar reducers. That, to me, just looks like a generic name. No? Mm.
I think there are going to be factions that don't have a one-cost shot that...
That's quite possible.
...reduce something. And that is going to be pretty important because it's basically one more income provider, especially when there's no Valor that can remove it from the game.
Well, Wildfire will frequently strip that.
Okay.
Targ, we've seen a few new cards. I think we're probably going to skip on talking about it because I have a pre-recorded segment with John about it where we go over things like Jorah and the like. However, if you have some overall thoughts about Targ...
One thing about Jorah. Okay, I'm not going to start with the token mess, but what I want to mention is Brightwater Man-at-Arms. That's it.
Yeah, I agree. that is sufficient. He is an amazing character. Absolutely amazing. And Brightwater Man-at-Arms is probably the best way to summarize that. Then the last faction that we are seeing for the very first time is Tyrell.
Yes.
And they actually gave us quite a few new cards to it. And it actually looks like it might be a very, very fun faction to play with some challenge tricks.
Yeah, it's interesting because they had to build this identity from scratch because there wasn't a faction before that they could use as sort of a templating. It looks interesting with a lot of challenge tricks, but not challenge tricks that come from hand, but rather are on the board already. So it just makes it difficult to get through because you're adaptable to whatever your opponent throws at you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Marjorie is a strength boost in challenges, clearly synergizes with Randall, who, if he gets boosted, gets to stand and has renown. So you've got some basic synergy. The Knight of Flowers is a 5-strength character, but if he gets boosted by Marjorie, he's going to win whatever challenge he's in because your opponent can only block with one character. So all these cards do seem to be synergizing very well. But I think... it's not entirely fair to say they don't have from hand challenge tricks because that Elena's Informant looks fantastic.
Yeah, especially with characters that can stand, like Randall Tarly, you'll be able to initiate 2 military challenges. And as we already mentioned, military challenges are going to be very good in the initial meta because there are not going to be as many characters on the board. So hitting for two claim military challenges in one phase could just wipe your opponent's board out.
And I think it's worth noting that Olena herself, the Queen of Thorns, synergizes well with Olena's Informant. She can drop Olena's Informant in for free. May not be the best choice if you have a Knight of Flowers or whatever in your hand. You'll probably drop them instead. But you can drop it in for free, and she still came into play and gets to trigger the effect that allows you to declare another challenge. Since she's standing, you could at least get another Intrigue or Power Challenge in. So I think we'll be seeing a lot of her, too. And I like the fact that the ambush cost is higher than the play cost. I think that creates, again, decision points where you say, okay, I really need a body this turn and I won't be able to ambush her, so I'll lose the effect, but I'll play her for cheaper. I think that makes sense to have that in there. And so Widow's Wail with the other extreme where you're always going to be ambushing it. Here, you're usually going to ambush it. You're going to want to ambush it. But there are situations in which you might not.
I've just checked back on the Mattel cards. To see if Arianne is loyal, and she isn't. So I'm looking forward to dropping in Olena's Informant with Arianne in either Tyrell or Martell.
Right, because Olena's Informant is not loyal either, so you certainly will be able to play with both. No, I like this a lot. I think.
And that also it takes away the telegraph part of your combat tricks that are printed on Marjorie, Tyrell, or something. Now you can bounce your Arianne to put in Marjorie and then use her ability, which now is a surprise effect. I really like that.
None of the cards we've seen so far are loyal, right? Marjorie is
Olena.
Not. Yeah, Olena herself. So Queen of Thorns is. But Randall is not. The Knight of Flowers is not. Marjorie is not. Olena's Informant is not. And I guess the Mander, which we see something about drawing 2 cards. So it's sort of the 3-cost draw 2 cards staple. Is
loyal. I would assume that Highgarden is loyal as well. Because all the 3-cost locations are loyal, I think.
Yeah, but Martell didn't have a 3-cost location, right? But
yeah, only
all the
2-cost
other ones
locations.
We've seen have been loyal, yeah.
Makes sense, because they're the big locations that have these identifying abilities that make the factions unique. which makes them loyal and usually unique.
All right. Well, that's pretty much all the spoilers that we have there. I'm excited. I realize that we're mere weeks away from Gen Con and me getting my grubby little paws on hopefully 3 core sets, hopefully like 20, but you know, there's so many people asking me, if you pick up an additional one, will you, you know, send it to me and I'll pay you and I'll pay you the shipping. I'll wind up becoming my own shipping company if it happens like that. So I doubt I can bring that many back on the plane, but you know, it's probably the tutorial video more than the spoilers, seeing the game played out on a board like that with both sides and all the art and everything really ties it all together very nicely. And my excitement is at its maximum.
Yeah, my nerd boner is definitely excited.
Okay, well, Florian, thanks for joining me. I'm glad you're nerd boner. There's got to be a way to sort of turn that into a single word. We already have Viper Active.
Bird Nona? Banana? Banana?
I'm glad your banana is... I think I'm not going to comment on your banana. Well, closing comments. Last week we mentioned that it was a bit of a lull. There was only one tournament, and that was the Norwich Regional, great though it was. Things have not really picked up again for this weekend. There are only 3 that I know of. There's one in Vienna in Austria, one in Sydney, Australia, and one in Pinerolo in Italy. It looks like there are a bunch of regionals over the next 2 weeks, basically to close out the regional season. And then Gen Con, which should be what everybody's thinking about. In addition to all that, it's worth noting that next week we will be joined by Dark Noj again, so hopefully you'll have the co-hosts you love rather than the co-host who... I'm not going to finish that sentence.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
I have to, oh god, word.
Run. Walk, pee, poop, eat.
I have to poop. Well, see you in 30 minutes.
Good lord.